Okay, please turn to the 18th chapter of Acts, if you would. We have a short text that we're going to consider this morning. It's only a paragraph long. And it will close a circle. We began some weeks ago as a missionary team left Antioch. For the second time, Antioch becomes a sending city for missionaries. They left on a long adventure, have been to the cities of Philippi and other places first in preparation and over long and difficult roads, finally to the cities of Philippi, Thessalonica, Berea, Athens, and now they are in Corinth, our mission team. And at the end of this morning, Paul is going to leave that place and return finally to Antioch where he had come from. And this is the text we want to learn from today. But I want to remind you a little bit of the setting before I read, starting in verse 18. Corinth is the last of this series of cities that I mentioned. It was, in many respects, the most difficult place, on one level, the most difficult place to do ministry. It was a wild and aggressive and rich and self-impressed sort of place. The church that was founded there was a church that was important in its day, but it was also a difficult church, one that had all the problems of its region. And Paul arrived in Corinth. You may recall, we talked about this last week, depleted when he got there. He was said of himself in the first letter to the Corinthians that when I first came to you, I arrived with fear and trembling. He had gone through a great deal of difficulty. He'd been in prison, he'd been beaten, he'd been rejected, he'd been uncertain of how things would come out. He'd founded churches he worried about. And it's as if kind of the long work of ministry and adventure had taken a toll on the man. He was faithful nonetheless. He fulfilled his calling, but I think we can well imagine that Paul himself was at a state of need in his life. And in the midst of his time in Corinth, the Lord appeared to him. Remember, we talked about that last week as well. Verse 9 of chapter 18. The Lord said to Paul in a vision by night, "Do not be afraid any longer, but go on speaking and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no man will attack you in order to harm you, for I have many people in this city." And he settled there for a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them. So the Lord came, and even in Jesus' vision to Paul, his first word to him is, "Stop being afraid. You don't need to be afraid any longer." It's further evidence, I think, that Paul was struggling and had needs in his own heart at this point in his career. He stays for a year and a half and pastors this church in a difficult city, a difficult church. He taught the word of God to them faithfully and pastored them. And at the end of this time, 3 years have gone by since he ventured out from Antioch. And that's where we'll pick up the story in verse 18. And abruptly, it seems, as we read it, Paul decides he must leave. Now is the time for him to leave and return to Antioch. So let's read the text, verse 18. Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria. And with him were Priscilla and Aquila. In Kenchrea he had his hair cut, for he was keeping a vow. They came to Ephesus, and he left them there. Now he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay for a longer time, he did not consent. But taking his leave of them and saying, "I will return to you again if God wills," he set sail from Ephesus. When he landed at Caesarea, he went up and greeted the church and then went down to Antioch. Now, in my mind, the paragraph ought to end there. A lot of English texts will have verse 23 in the same paragraph as if it's the same idea. And having spent some time there, he left and passed successively through the Galatian region and Phrygia, strengthening the disciples. But that 23rd verse is actually the description of the next journey, the third of the missionary journeys. And we're going to break here at 22 and come back and start in the fall again. We'll come back to the book of Acts starting in the fall, and we'll finish the book. But it seems to me, maybe not in grammatical terms, but in actual testimony of events, the break occurs between verses 22 and 23. There's two things I want to suggest that we focus on in this little paragraph, this short passage. The first is the vow that is made. It includes a haircut. It includes some other references to a choice Paul made to take a vow before the Lord. The second thing I want us to look at is how determined he is to get to his destination. It matters to him very much that he finish this trip that he's begun, so much so that he turns aside opportunities as they present themselves to him. So I think we can see this is very important that he get where he's going. And I hope we can learn from both what this vow is and what it represented and meant to him. We aren't being taught that we should make vows or we should make trips. We're looking at Paul's choice to make a vow and make a trip. This isn't one of the kind of teaching passages that says Christians should act this way. But there's a reason why he acted this way. And my hope is that we'll see that reason and find it helpful to us in making choices of our own. The vow and the determined journey, those are where we'll give our focus. I do want to make a couple of comments just about some of the details here to kind of get it in view, and then we'll look at those two points. First is that Paul initiates this trip for no reason that we're given. It seems to be his idea. Something is happening to him. And it says, after many days, he took leave and left. He travels along with Priscilla and Aquila for some of the time, but he even leaves them and finally goes off on his own. You may remember last week I mentioned that being alone, traveling from Athens to Corinth, was a heavy and hard thing. In this case, being alone is evidently a good thing. He's excited, joyful, anticipatory of where he's going. But it's his initiative. It's not persecution. It's not a vision from the Lord that we know of. It's not any kind of circumstantial events. His friends don't say, Paul, it's time for you to leave. None of that. It just seems to be his. Something is inside the man that is creating this event. Yeah, another thing, just let me say in passing, this trip is 1,500 miles long. This is no small deal. He takes off on a ship. He travels over land. It's a long going. He will stay in Antioch once he gets there, probably 3/4 of a year. This is a sort of big period of time, and it's an extended trip, and yet it's treated in as we see here, just a few sentences. We don't get much detail about it. There are two cities that he's determined to get to. It's not so obvious unless you know the way that Jerusalem was referred to. But it says in 22, when he landed at Caesarea, which was the port city nearest to Jerusalem, the port city on the Mediterranean Sea, he went up and greeted the church and went down to Antioch. What church did he go up to greet and go down from? Well, it is certainly the church in Jerusalem, the Christians in Jerusalem. He was himself going to Jerusalem. That's the first place that he went, and then to Antioch. The phrase to go up to and go down from is always used of Jerusalem in the Bible. Jerusalem is at a high point in the center of the nation of Israel, and it is spiritually the highest point in the world for Jews. And the verb used of travel to Jerusalem is to go up. Travel from Jerusalem is always to go down to some other place. So he's gone first at the end of his trip to Jerusalem, and then finally to the place where he started, to Antioch. Well, what about the vow that he makes? It's again, we just kind of know that it exists. There's a haircut that happens. What is taking place here is not, again, Luke doesn't call a lot of attention to it, but it piques our curiosity to read about it, doesn't it? Again, there's very little question as to what Paul was doing here. There is a provision made in the Old Testament for Jewish worship. The provision is the vow of a Nazarite. I'm going to read a section of Numbers 6 in just a minute where the vow of the Nazarite is described. And it's a voluntary thing that you could at some time in your life, for reasons of gratitude, this Jewish believers, for reasons of gratitude to God or reasons of personal discipline or something else, could undertake a commitment to make a vow, to subject yourself to a discipline. And that's clearly what happens here, and the haircut is actually the thing that makes it clear what Paul was doing. The details are odd, why he would cut his hair in Cenchrea, whether he began the Nazarite vow with a haircut and will have one subsequently as well or not. It's hard to know all of what was taking place, but it marks this choice by Paul as clearly a Nazarite vow. And so our question then is, what can we learn from it? And then we'll move on to the second point from there. Let me read to you some of the text of number 6. You don't have to turn there. I'm going to excerpt this a little bit, but just give you an idea of what this was about. The Lord said to Moses, "Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord as a Nazarite, he must abstain from wine and other fermented drink, must not drink vinegar made from wine or other fermented drink. He must not drink grape juice or eat grapes or raisins. As long as he is a Nazarite, he must not eat anything that comes from the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins. During the entire period of his vow of separation, no razor may be used on his head. He must be holy until the period of separation to the Lord is over. He must let the hair of his head grow long. Now this is the law of the Nazarite when the period of separation is over. He is to be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, that would be the tabernacle or the temple. There he is to present his offerings to the Lord. Then at the entrance to the tent of meeting, the Nazarite must shave off his hair that he has dedicated. He is to take the hair and put it in the fire that is under the sacrifice of the fellowship offering." As I said, this is a voluntary thing you choose to do, and it's got really two pieces to it. You let your hair grow, and you don't go anywhere near grapes. Any kind of grapes, wine, vinegar, grape skins, grape seeds, grape stems, grape leaves, anything that had to do with grapes in any form, you stay away from those and you let your hair grow. Now this is not an onerous, difficult assignment. It has about it, though, the requirement that you pay attention to what you're doing. In the Mediterranean basin to this day, and certainly in the time of Moses and in the time of Paul, grapes were everywhere in all of the countries that surrounded the Mediterranean. All of them grew grapes. All of them served grapes with meals. All of them had vinegar that were used as a preservative. All of them had grape vines and vineyards regularly to be encountered as you pass through all of the regions of this place. Every meal, or almost every meal, would have some, either wine with it, grapes, vinegar, something. In order to carry this out, you had to pay attention. That's really the sticking point. You couldn't go on autopilot throughout the day. You had to think about what you were doing. If you're walking down the road and there was a vineyard alongside, you might go off to the other side so that you don't brush up against these grapes that you've vowed yourself to stay away from. If a meal was served to you, you'd pick through the stew to find out if there was a grape in there and pull it out before you ate the stew. You might be in five or six settings throughout the day where you would have to attentively stand back, withdraw, graciously decline, something like that. And the point is to be put in a situation where, by being attentive to what you're doing, by paying attention to what life brings at you, you will, in saying no, be reminded of Christ for Christians. Be reminded of the Lord. The Nazarite vow didn't require you to sell everything and go live with lepers. It wasn't a tough thing to do, but it meant that you had to be alert throughout the day. And being alert throughout the day would give you opportunities, repeated opportunities in the discipline you undertook, to thank the Lord as you're reminded of Him. To ask yourself, are my thoughts what they ought to be? Now, here in this setting, I'm going to step aside from this opportunity because I must, given my vow. But in doing so, I'll be reminded of the Lord. it will give me a chance to attend to him. The fact that hair grows, I think, is telling another truth, and that is that God changes us slowly. If you look in the mirror today and observe your hair and look again tomorrow, you won't be able to see much change. But if you look in the mirror today and then come back in 6 or 8 weeks, you will. There is change that takes place over time. There is slow change that takes place. And that's really the way God sanctifies us. He does it incrementally in most cases. He makes changes that we can only see if we observe them over time. And I think that's part of this vow as well. Now, evangelicals have been more alert to the issues of spiritual discipline in the last 15 or 20 years than they were, I think, for many decades before. There's a lot of books that are written for folks in churches like ours about spiritual discipline, about undertaking a withdrawal, about putting oneself in a restriction of some kind for the sake of the Lord. And I think they're very helpful, and I commend them to you. It is something that's an important way that we can relate to God. We have much to learn from the literature of spiritual disciplines. They're voluntary. They're chosen for a time and a place and a reason that's personal. But I think they can be very helpful to us. And I think Paul's example here is probably an encouragement to turn that direction ourselves. What they are not, however, let me just make a point in the negative. This is not a battle with sin. Face on. There are other kinds of discipline that we undertake because the thing we are turning from is itself wrong. We do battle with our tendency to be greedy and lustful, our tendency to gossip, our tendency to jealousy, our tendency to live sinful lives. And we're told to put to death the things of the flesh and to be raised again with Christ. We're told to put off the old self and put on the new. There are battles and disciplines and choices we make because the thing itself we are resisting is sinful and wrong. But that's not the case here. Grapes are not a bad thing. Of all the produce of the earth, grapes are some of the most honorable in the Bible, as a matter of fact. And it's the same with with other spiritual disciplines as well. The discipline of fasting doesn't mean there's anything wrong with food. We might make a choice to withdraw from eating in a particular way or a particular kind of fast, but not because there's anything wrong with food. We might choose solitude as a spiritual discipline where we pull away from the world and pull away from our friends and spend time in silence. Not because there's anything wrong with our friends or that we should be distant from the world or we should always be quiet. Speech and fellowship are good things. But there is a choice, perhaps, to withdraw from them because we want the opportunity to give the Lord first focus, first place. Hear His voice. Turn off other language, other noise, other calls for our time and attention. So the thing Paul has chosen to do here and the thing we might choose to do similarly is not a direct battle with sin, but it is a restriction. And if it can have the effect of giving you a chance 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 8 times during the day to say, Lord, I'm reminded of you now. Thank you. Change me. I repent. To have that kind of interaction with the Lord, then it will have the good effect that I think it had on Paul. He was at a time of his life where he had poured himself out, where he'd spent a lot of himself, where he had given away the life of Christ to others extensively and regularly and every day and sort of without a break. He'd spent 3 years doing it. And I think now he has turned and said, Lord, I want time with you. I want attention given to you. And so he, as a Jew, chooses this way of doing it. Try to think of some examples that might be kind of useful in a culture like ours, and most of them are electronic. We're not an agricultural, we don't live in an agricultural world. We don't kind of regularly see things grow and see growing things produced into food and so on. You often eat stuff, you have no idea what's in there, I think, in our culture. But we're surrounded by electronic stuff. And it struck me that one thing that might be similar to this in my own case is to turn off the car radio. I don't like driving along the car with nothing going on. I mean, if there's someone with me to talk to, that's great. But if there's not, I always have something turned. I don't like kind of the quiet and silence and dead space. But if I were to do something analogous to Paul's Nazarite vow, that would be probably a good choice for me because I'm in the car enough that I'd be reminded often enough, oh, Lord, this is a good chance to talk to you, isn't it? Wait a minute, it's quiet in here. That means, oh, I know what that means. That means that I've chosen a restriction that will give me the chance to be grateful, to sing a hymn, to offer a prayer. And the gap, the missing thing, the saying no offers an opportunity to say yes. Another similar thing might be turning off, obviously, cell phones, restricting how much news you have kind of instantaneously at your fingertip. There's other ways, I think, to enter into a discipline that gives you a chance to think of and appreciate and recognize the daily presence of the Lord. So Paul took a vow. He took about this time of his life because he needed it at this time of his life. At the end of 3 years, he left Corinth because he needed to leave Corinth. He had spent himself, and what he needed was help. He needed himself to feast on the Christ that he had been giving away as a meal to other people. He needed to live days of his life with attentiveness to God, and I think he chose this to do it. But the other thing that he does that I mentioned is determine that he will go to the cities of Jerusalem and Antioch, and nothing will get in the way. And we know that because when he gets to Ephesus, for the first time in Paul's experience as an apostle, he goes into a synagogue and they want him there. Stay, teach us, this is terrific. This, you know, we want to believe. And there's this wide open door to ministry in Ephesus. They had to pass by that region when they were going north on the journey the first time. They are now come back there. There's a chance to stay, the very thing that he longed to do, and he says, no, I will not stay. I'll come back. And he does come back eventually to Ephesus. But I cannot stay now. I'm headed someplace that I need to get to. And that place is the city of Jerusalem and the cities of Jerusalem and Antioch. Why is that? What do they represent for him? I think they each represent home. A home of a sort. They're different slightly, but they represent places that kind of resonate deeply with this man. Paul first learned to pray as a Jew. His first prayers were surely the Psalms of the Old Testament. His first encounter with the holiness of God was surely in the sacrifices of the temple. His first hearing of the righteousness of God was the telling of the commandments of God. His first instruction that the world is filled with the glory of the Lord came in Judaism. So for Paul to go back to Jerusalem was for Paul to go back to a place where God had first made himself known to this man. Judaism didn't save Paul. In fact, it eventually corrupted him. But the Lord that he met there was the living God. The prayers that he prayed there in the beginning were prayers that were written by men of faith. And I think what Paul is reminding himself is that I am not in the first place, at the core of myself, the one who is busiest and most active. I am at the core of myself, the one who believes these things. The older I get, the more frequently I do memorial services than weddings. It used to be when I was younger, I did a lot of weddings and very rarely would bury anybody. Now it's just the opposite. It seems like there's more opportunities to say goodbye to people and fewer to marry them as a pastor. But it has struck me increasingly as I meet with people when someone has died that the majority of folks in the room who have gathered there don't know who they are. They don't even know how to ask questions of their core. What do I believe? Where am I going? They haven't been formed by any great thing. And in this half an hour, 45 minutes or an hour that we meet for memorial service is one of the few times when death and God and eternity and heaven and hell are all in play. That our world takes that from us, aggressively takes that from us. And Paul was determined not to let his ministry or anything else take it from him anymore. He was going back to Jerusalem to greet the church, but also, I think, to be on his knees before the God that he first met in Jerusalem. And he goes to Antioch for essentially a very similar reason. Antioch was the place where Paul became an apostle in practice. He had been called before that by Christ, but for the first time there was a group of elders in a church that laid hands on him and said, by the Spirit of God, you are called to do the ministry God made you for. Antioch was the place where Paul's Christian leadership was first established, where he was first believed in, where he was first understood, where folks knew him. And he was going back to that place as a home as well, to be embraced, built up, to report on his ministry, to be understood, to be welcomed. He's going back to his Christian roots as well. And I think Paul needed this because everybody, for the same reason that everybody, needs times like this. Many folks in this congregation right now have been on the road too long in this telling. 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, 15 years, since you last looked very hard at what you believe the most and love the most, and said no to some things and have gone to some place where the attention is given to Christ alone. We've spent so much of ourselves there. There are too many among us that don't even remember for sure and can't articulate completely, what is it I believe again? How did I start this journey with God? What were the truths that mattered most to me then and need to matter most to me now about who God is and who I am? And I think Paul's journey home to Antioch in both cases was a recognition that he couldn't go on forever without replenishing what was on the inside, without drinking deeply from the well of the truest things. And I hope that his example, both to have a daily series of reminders that God's here, he knows, and I can say thank you, and that I am formed by things that have very deep roots, roots that need to be watered and learned from and gone back to. But that at the core, if we are Christians, there are some profound, beautiful, life-giving realities that we'll do very well to give repeated attention to take a break from other stuff in order to know them and believe them again. To go home. Go to a place where God met you. Go to a place where the people of God will support you, where they'll listen and be part of the good reforming of your heart of hearts. Well, that's the end of the second missionary journey. It ends with a man heading toward the Lord. He went out in service and ministry. He ends going back to a place where I think he can receive from the Lord. They're both are great ways to think about the Christian life. I'm here to give away what I've been given, and I'm here to rejoice in what I've been given. Both are true. We're going to end that with an unusual benediction this morning, not a prayer, not a song. We're going to end with a slideshow. And it's one in which we're going to rejoice in this place as a spiritual home. This has been my spiritual home for a long time. There are people that I know because I've been part of this church that I go to when I need to sort of get my head back put on straight. And that's probably true for a lot of folks. This is a living community that can have that sort of contribution made to each of us. So we're going to celebrate our community. We've talked about this being Servant Sunday. And let me just say very quickly, we were given a ton of slides. We can't use them all. Probably we'll only use maybe a third or a quarter of the ones we were given. So if you've turned in slides and you don't see yours up here, we're grateful for yours. We just couldn't get them all on the program. Remember that just after this, we're going to want to go out for the baptism and then on to the picnic. That's all part of the Servant Sunday celebration. And lastly, as some of you are doing, I suggest if you're in the wings, you might want to slide over a little bit so you can see more clearly what there is to see here. Say thanks to the Lord Jesus as you see these faces and reminded of these things. We, We're not just kind of celebrating ourselves. We're celebrating the one who gave his life for us. So we'll conclude and then off to the baptism with this slideshow.